This program is a production of WAMC News and is made possible with funds provided by the State University of New York College at New Paltz. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly news magazine examining the activities of state government. Is political scientist and syndicated columnist, Dr. Alan Chartok of the State University.
In this edition of the Legislative Gazette, we'll hear about what is sure to be one of the most controversial issues facing the legislature this year, sentencing reform. We'll talk with Senator Mary Goodhue and get the latest reading on Governor Cuomo's performance in office. The criminal justice system has been criticized for being unfair. For example, a black man in New York City and a white woman in Albany are convicted of exactly the same crime. They have the same backgrounds and circumstances, but the black man gets a tougher sentence. In 1983, Governor Cuomo created the New York State Committee on Sentencing Guidelines with the goal of creating a more equitable criminal justice system. After 1 year of work, the committee this week presented its preliminary report to a joint legislative committee. Rick Lepkowski reports.
The goal of the commission? A tough task. Create a criminal sentencing system where two people convicted of the same crime with similar criminal records would receive the same sentence. Currently, New York State operates under an indeterminate sentencing system where the sentencing is largely left up to the discretion of a judge. The Sentencing Commission is drafting the outline for a determinate sentencing system, where sentences for particular crimes would be mandated by state statute. Only a small percentage of offenders currently serve their entire sentence in prison. Under the system the committee is proposing, if an offender is sentenced 15 years in prison, he would serve 15 years, minus only specified reductions for good behavior. The Sentencing Committee, through a complicated formula using figures provided by the State Department of Corrections, ranked crimes according to their severity and established a sentence ranged based on the violator's previous criminal record. The end result? Tougher sentences for major felonies and lesser sentences for lesser felonies. The chairman of the New York State Committee on Sentencing Guidelines, Joseph Bellicosa, says a determinate sentencing scheme would not cure the problem of crime, but he sees it as a very important part of an overall solution.
The relatively greater certainty of the amounts of punishment that would be imposed upon criminals will have a beneficial effect on all concerned, the defendants, the victims, society at large, and the institutional components, all of them, that have to deal with this massive problem in our society.
Although on the surface, the Commission's recommendations appear to serve the needs of the public who may have lost faith in our criminal justice system, but look a little deeper, and there are definite issues that should be raised. For example, other states that have implemented a determinate sentencing system, Minnesota, for example, have experienced a dramatic increase in their prison populations. New York's prisons are already filled 116% of capacity. Although Committee Chairman Bellicosa claims prison populations will not rise more than is already predicted, Van Zwijzen of the New York State Coalition for Criminal Justice claims a determinate sentencing scheme would balloon New York's prison population. In addition, Zwijzen says the committee's report fails to include the state's top criminal justice priorities, like reducing prison overcrowding and the implementation of alternatives to incarceration programs.
The public, as well as everyone in government, is interested in crime control and crime reduction. We had an opportunity to build in the rest of the state's system alternatives to incarceration that the governor has been pushing for. A rational look at prison overcrowding, presumptive parole legislation, prison capping. All these things have been completely missed. We're going to see the usual sort of tough-on-crime debate, and even as Mr. Bellicosa said, sentencing reform has no relation to crime control.
When the legislature debated whether to create the Sentencing Commission in 1983, many thought it would result in longer and stricter sentencing, a get-tough approach to dealing with criminals. Assemblyman Dove Hykind of Brooklyn claims the public has lost faith in our criminal justice system, and he was expecting recommendations that would restore the public's faith in the way the system deals with murderers, rapists, etc. But Hykind says the report he was handed did not do that.
I think the perception is, when people read about this and they use the word determinant sentencing, I think the perception of the average person is, oh, we're finally going to clean up a situation that is very bad, and that is that that one person gets arrested for a particular crime, another person for a similar type of crime, and they receive totally different kind of sentences. Okay, that this commission is finally going to present recommendations which we're going to adopt, and we're going to deal with the problem. And, you know, the judge who's the chairman of the commission made it pretty clear today that no one is going to serve longer in prison overall. And one of my colleagues raised a specific example of second-degree murder, and under questioning, the chairman of this commission admitted that the person might actually end up in jail for a shorter period of time.
Under our current sentencing system, the judge plays a major role in determining what penalty one should receive for one's crime. But under the determinant sentencing scheme, the judge's role in sentencing would be minimal. Arnold Proshkin is a freshman assemblyman from Colony and is a former Albany County judge and district attorney. He says determinant sentencing would virtually eliminate the discretion of judges, something he says is an integral part of our criminal justice system.
My problem is that the concept of saying that a judge should be like an IBM computer and say, well, you must go this certain number, we'll say, I'd be totally against it. It seems that everyone's going to be opposed to this. This is goring everyone's ox. I feel that there has to be a balance that has to be weighed. I know that, for instance, Albany County done very well. This goes back to 68 when I was district attorney, and I think we've done very well insofar as meeting out proper just sentences. Now, it may be more severe than New York County, but that's somebody else's problem. The closer that they get to taking the discretion away from the judges and the prosecutors, the more violently opposed I would be.
The report presented to the legislators this past week is just a preliminary report. The New York State Committee on Sentencing Guidelines will now hold a series of public hearings in Albany, Buffalo, and New York City, then will draft a final report, which will be presented to the legislature on or before April 1st. In Albany, I'm Rick Lepkowski.
The latest public opinion poll by the Marist College Institute for Public Opinion was released this week. With a look at some of the highlights, here's the man who directs the Institute, Lee Marengoff.
Mario Cuomo's popularity remains at the top of the charts, according to a survey conducted by the Marist College Institute for Public Opinion. This was the main finding of what we released this week in Albany. The poll of New York State voters, 602 of them, was taken in the evening following the governor's State of the State address. People were selected at random and interviewed by telephone throughout New York State, and they sort of represent a microcosm of the state itself. They like the way Governor Cuomo is handling his job, and they want him to seek re-election as governor in 1986. A full 64% of the respondents gave the governor either a good or an excellent rating. This is essentially unchanged from a similar poll we conducted in September. His approval rating is up 5 points since a year ago. There are several interesting factors contributing to his popularity. First, 72% of the Democrats gave Governor Cuomo a favorable rating. That's not terribly surprising. But a full 57% of the Republicans also approve of the job he's doing. That demonstrates more than anything else, I think, the wide appeal the governor has established in his 2 years as chief executive in New York State. Second, 65% of the city voters gave him a positive vote of support. Again, that's no great surprise, but 60% of the upstaters and 72% of suburban residents rate him either as excellent or good. That means that Mario Cuomo is doing very well in those sections of New York State where Democrats typically do poorly. In the suburbs, the swing area in New York State, and the area where Ronald Reagan racked up the hugest pluralities, Governor Cuomo's strong showing is particularly noteworthy. After all, Democrats are searching for leaders with appeal to higher-income, younger professional voters, and Governor Cuomo seems to have a good handle on how to appeal to those individuals. I'd suggest two reasons to help explain this unusual phenomenon. Governor Cuomo's brand of what he calls progressive pragmatism successfully blends a traditional appeal for social awareness with what is viewed as sound fiscal policies by these voters. Also, the suburban voters may not be quite as conservative as recent elections have suggested. On issues such as environmental protection, aid to senior citizens, and discrimination against minorities, there's a close match between what the governor is stressing and what surveys show these citizens desire. Finally, Governor Cuomo has been able to present himself in a national way without sacrificing his appeal statewide. 73% believe he's a good leader for New York State. Two-thirds of the sample believe he takes clearly defined positions on issues. And almost 60% believe he's fulfilling campaign promises. Only 36% believe he's paying too much attention to national politics and not enough attention to New York State. If the governor compiles a successful legislative record this session and further concretizes his philosophy and develops a track record of programs and policies, then it's likely that his midterm report card will remain untarnished as the governor approaches his reelection effort. Already, 65% of the state voters want him to seek reelection as governor in 2 years. In the next few weeks, I'll be reporting on the legislative agenda and what the public thinks on a variety of issues facing this session. In the meantime, for the Legislative Gazette, this is Lee Marengoff at the Marist College Institute for Public Opinion in Poughkeepsie.
And now, speaking of popularity, here's the ever-popular, ever-present, ever-challenging Frederick U. Dicker of the New York Post.
You've heard it here first, but I don't expect a whole lot of credit for prescience. If, as we all expect, Governor Cuomo seeks re-election next year, he'll win easily and overwhelmingly. The simple truth is that the Republican Party in this state doesn't have anyone of stature to challenge Governor Cuomo. And unlike 1982, when Cuomo first ran for office as governor, an out-of-the-blue, big-money candidate like Lou Lerman just won't have what it takes to defeat the governor at this time. If there was any further need for proof of Cuomo's incredible popularity with the voters, it came last week from the Marist Institute for Public Opinion in Poughkeepsie. The well-regarded institute produced a poll of 602 New Yorkers, selected at random and balanced by geographical region, religion, and most importantly, by political affiliation. The poll showed that Cuomo enjoys a good or excellent rating from 64% of the voters, a figure that, according to previous Marist polls, has remained almost constant for more than a year. Most importantly, the poll showed Cuomo winning the backing of a majority of self-described Republicans and conservatives, a message of certain political death to any would-be Republican challenger. Indeed, George Clark, the able if sometimes strident voice of New York Republicans, appeared flabbergasted by the poll's results. "I don't understand," said Clark, who is the state Republican chairman, "how conservatives can say that Cuomo is a conservative and liberals can say that Cuomo is a liberal. It may be that the governor is a consummate politician. He's doing something right as a politician, although I'm not sure he's doing things right being governor." Clark, who's been scouting the state for months for potential opponents to Cuomo, certainly has his work cut out for him. His party's few statewide luminaries, like State Comptroller Ned Regan and Senate Majority Leader Warren Anderson, give no indication whatsoever that they're interested in challenging the governor next year. One name that surfaced recently was that of Manhattan State Republican Senator Roy Goodman, a millionaire who ran for New York City mayor several years ago. But in that contest, he won, if you can believe it, only about 5% of the vote. The fact that a politician with such a poor track record can be treated as a serious potential Republican challenger just illustrates how desperate the Republicans are. Why is Cuomo as popular as he is? There's no question that the governor's great eloquence and charm, which at times crosses the border into genuine charisma, is largely responsible for his success. Certainly his record as governor to date can't account for his remarkable achievement. What I find really interesting now, however, is an implicit recognition from Cuomo that his substantive record as governor is probably the weakest suit in his political deck of cards. Thus, his State of the State message earlier this month and the budget he'll outline on Tuesday appears geared in large part to fill in that gaping hole in his tenure as governor. It seems certain that Cuomo will come away from this legislative session with the one accomplishment politicians prize overall, a substantial tax cut for the voters. Add to that his efforts to reform state fiscal practices, increase the number of middle and lower class housing units, and boost welfare payments for the poor, and you have a genuine record of accomplishment. If it's well nigh impossible to beat Cuomo now, think of how tough it will be for the Republicans next year. Trying to stay attuned at the Capitol, this is Fred Dicker of the New York Post.
Most members of the legislature head into the session with at least one major issue on their personal agendas. For some, it's energy. For others, the environment. For Republican State Senator Mary Goodhue of Mount Kisco, children and children's issues are high on the agenda.
Senator, in your capacity as chairperson of the Senate Child Care Committee, what are your major interests this year?
Well, this year we're awfully interested in doing something about child abuse. You remember the incidents in New York City, and we've had some in Westchester, and I'm sure there are plenty of them around the state. Nobody has approached the problem, and I'm talking now about child abuse in daycare centers. And there's just lots to be done. How careful do you have to be about the people that work in these centers? In the past, we haven't been very careful. They're very low-paying jobs. Nobody finds out whether they have criminal records. Nobody finds out whether they may have been guilty of child abuse in some other institution or other capacity. It's really a shocking situation, and I think that we've got a high priority to protect the children that go to these daycare centers from child abuse. The mothers have enough to worry about as it is. They've got to work, and they need to think that their children are properly taken care of.
Senator, how are you going to do it?
Well, what we're looking into is the kind of people that are employed in child care centers. We're looking at such things as requiring that their criminal records be searched. Now, civil liberties people are going to get upset by that. We have a child registry in this state which records complaints of child abuse. We've already mandated that registry should be checked for people hiring daycare workers.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily, I think probably we're going to have to lift the level of the job itself. We're going to have to pay more. We're going to have to insist on more requirements to be a child care worker, which is too bad because it'll make daycare more expensive.
Yes, I was just going to ask you about that. That's the downside of things. So now somebody who wants to put together a child care center in a neighborhood, for example, starts getting so many levels of bureaucracy and bureaucratic requirements put on them because of the exception, the jerk who does the child molestation, that sort of thing, that it almost becomes prohibitive in terms of starting something like this up. Isn't that a concern?
You've put your finger right on the problem. The more requirements we make, the more we insist that these people be paid, the more degrees we insist they have from schools and colleges, the more expensive the care gets, whether it gets any better, or who knows. So that's the problem. What we're trying to do is protect the children without making the cost prohibitive, without being ridiculous about it, without going overboard, but at the same time being absolutely certain that the children are protected.
How would something like that work? I mean, what you've done is to give us a very good general outline. Now, specifically, how do we achieve a balance of that kind?
Well, you got to get the right laws, which is what we're working on. One of the things we're looking to is this new bill that we passed last year, which I sponsored in the Senate, which is called the Latchkey Children Bill. As you, of course, know, a latchkey child mm-hmm. is a child old enough to go to school. It's not an infant. And it comes home from school and has its own key and goes into the house or the apartment, but there's nobody there.
How old are we talking about now?
Well, I suppose we could be talking about 8 years old,
mm-hmm.
Certainly 12 and 13-year-olds, and there's nobody there because the parents are both working and they don't get home when the schools get out. So we passed a bill last year suggesting that the school facilities be used for after-school daycare and putting some seed money in so that daycare programs could start up in schools. This is not to be at the burden of the school taxpayer, but
right.
These would be daycare people financed in their own way that would come into the schools.
Have the schools been asking for that money?
All over the place. I mean, the response has been unbelievable. The applications, hardly a week goes by that I don't get two or three calls saying, how do we apply for some of that money? We want to start an after-school daycare facility. Now, I have a feeling that this will take a little bit of the load off of some of our other daycare facilities and might help the child abuse situation, because I don't see child abuse going on in a school building with children this age. I could be wrong, but I just don't see it.
Well, the other side of that, of course, is every once in a while there's some sensational story about some teacher or up here recently a principal. There was a report gets involved in some kind of child molestation. But I suppose that's just the nature of the beast, that for every 1,000 people there's going to be somebody out there, I suppose. And as you suggested earlier, quite correctly, I think a master's degree doesn't really deal with that kind of impairment.
No, it doesn't. And you have to be very careful because, as you say, there will be a lot of allegations flying around that may not have any truth in them at all. I'm particularly suspicious of allegations between parents that used to be married.
Yes.
And the divorced wife says that her every time she sends a child to visit, you know, visitation rights with the divorced husband, that there has been sexual abuse on the part of the husband. I mean, I think you've got to take a lot of these complaints with a grain of salt. On the other hand, the more complaints you take with a grain of salt, the next thing you know, some kid is seriously injured.
That's right, Senator. I agree with everything you just said. Let me ask you, go on to another bill that I'm interested in, and that is how you make fathers who run out on their families pay up.
Ah, I'm so glad you asked. The federal government has just passed a really exciting bill, which was signed into law by the president just this fall, and it's called the Child Enforcement Law. And what it does is it extends the ways to get money by a person who has a child support order which is being ignored by his or her spouse. Usually, let's face it, it's the woman who is left with the kids, and the man goes off into the wild blue yonder and never sends any money home. So she goes and she gets a child support order. In the past, it has just been terribly, terribly difficult, even with the order, to enforce it. This new law will let the federal government reach after him. In the first place, there's a locator which will help find him if you don't know where he's gone. There's a federal locator that will help find him through Social Security numbers. When you've got him, under the new law, if there is so much as a month's arrear of child support, the court in the state in which he is located is mandated to deduct it from his wages, and that was never the case before. If there's more than $1,000 in arrearage, it will be reported to credit unions around the country, and there are a whole lot of other things in there which will make husbands who are under support orders cough up faster with their child support so that the taxpayer doesn't have to support these children.
Okay, now, Senator, that's the federal law. What does the state have to do? Is there an implementation
There are definite things that have to be conformed, and that comes under the purview of my child care committee. And right this minute in Albany, we got at least three people working on it. It's my hope that we get this bill right in and that we conform right down to the last semicolon with the federal law so that we can get all the help we can get from the federal government in locating these people. I mean, the people have to remember, you know, if there's anybody out there saying, gee, those poor fathers, they never can get out from under the burden. The issue is, should the father support the child or should the taxpayer support the child? If the mother is able to support the child, she's not running around looking so hard for the father. But for a mother who can't support a child, or where there's no mother and the child is in foster care, it is the taxpayer that's supporting the child. And if the father is able to support it, the father, darn it, should support his children.
Is there any trouble between you and the Assembly in this, or is this an identical philosophy? Do you both feel the same way?
I can't believe there'd be any trouble because we haven't got the bill completely drafted. I haven't sought Assembly sponsors. I understand the governor's office is also working on a bill. We'll all get together. It's important that we all know what the problems are, so that we sit down with a bunch of knowledgeable people, and we'll come with a bill that everybody will support.
Let me ask you a more personal question about yourself. You're the chair of this important committee dealing with children in the Senate, but you are also one of the few women in the Senate. Do you think it was sexual stereotyping that put you there?
No. At the time, when I was qualified to chair a committee, there were two vacancies, child care and agriculture, and our leader said I could have my choice. So I took child care, and it's a most interesting committee, and I've learned a lot.
Are you disillusioned by what you're seeing?
No, I never get disillusioned. I am stunned by the enormity of the problem. There are just so many children out there who do not have parents looking after them. Or if they have parents looking after them, the parents are doing such a terrible job, either because they are drug-ridden or they are alcoholic or they are insane, that the child is not getting the kind of upbringing that it needs to be a member of society so that it can get ahead on its own two feet. And the problems are just enormous. And it behooves us to see that these children are able to hold jobs, are able to live normal lives. Otherwise, we're going to be taking care of them ad infinitum.
State Senator Mary Goodhue makes for an interesting interview. She's tough and realistic, but committed to changing things when change is appropriate. For example, she knows that recent reports of child molestations in daycare centers are frightening and upsetting to parents. But there is also the possibility that by dealing with a relatively few violations, you will be upsetting the very fragile system which has been developed in communities around the state where some very level-headed and decent people have set up daycare centers in their homes and under very inexpensive conditions. Every time you ask that a daycare worker be certified, every time you ask that they have certain educational attainments, you cut into the capacity of the small entrepreneur to provide a service that everyone agrees is essential to our contemporary lifestyles. And certainly bureaucracy will continue to cover its own collective behinds by making one regulation after another. The Department of Health and the Department of Social Services, for example, have already put many demands on daycare centers. No more than 6 children in some cases, fire codes, sanitary codes, zoning expectations. So because of the recent scares, we will construct a registry of known sex offenders who will be checked out in advance. We will license facilities. We will make more and more demands. But you know what? I'll bet that somehow sexual deviants will continue to find their ways into our schools, our daycare centers, and our homes, despite all the regulations. So what the society has to do is to try its best to set standards, but to do so in such a way that we don't throw the baby out with the dirty water. That's why it's good that the legislative process is a fairly arduous one. That's why it's good that bill-setting standards have to find their way through two houses, and why hearings are held allowing for neighborhoods and well-meaning people who run daycare centers to come forward and complain. And even when all the regulations are written and all the committees and all the publicity is done, some poor lady who's been doing a great job for very little money will be told she can't continue because of the new regulations or the new laws, and she will not have known a thing about it. That's why we wish Senator Mary Goodhue and her staff the best of luck and the wisdom of Solomon in figuring all of this out. That's our show for this week. Please join us again next week for another look at state government and politics. Bill Gralty produces and edits this program. Richard P. Lepkowski is associate editor. Address comments and questions to us at WAMC, Box 13000, Albany, New York, 12212. I'm Alan Chartok.
The Legislative Gazette is produced by WAMC News. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds from the State University of New York College at New Paltz.